My name is Zahid Said. I am Communications TSP in Mid-Atlantic District. And I have my colleague, Tim, here with me. So I'm with Microsoft, I think, since 2011. Before that, I was working more with Cisco, like since 10 to 12 years, more about the Cisco. I was a deployment engineer, solution architect. And today, I would like to cover about the link deployment and management about that. And I will let first Tim introduce himself, then we will talk about the session, yeah?
Hi, everybody. My name is Tim Marang. I'm a technology specialist for Link, in, as Zahid mentioned, in the Mid-Atlantic region. I'm about a 10-year veteran of the product group, so recently moved to the field. So hopefully, you know, we have some good information for you. Any questions you might have, we'd be able to answer them for you.
Thanks, Tim. So in the agenda, I just want to set the expectations. We will cover about the link deployment, and we have one slide on the have a sponsor. How is it important to have a sponsor during a deployment? And we will do a deep dive about the link call routing. And then the, Tim will cover about the other services like response group, unassigned, and all of those enterprise features. And we will also talk about the devices. What we are not going to cover here is location-based routing, right? Just want to set the expectation. So this is covered by Doug Lottie in another session. I think it's either tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. And we are not covering interop with the PBX. But if there are any questions you think you want to ask, happy to answer that. Because I am, as I said, since last like 10 years, I'm working more on Cisco side, so I know the interop scenarios. But this is not the like the agenda which we are covering today. And we are not covering call admission control. So this is the high level on that. By the way, before I start, just a quick question. How many people here have like Avaya or Cisco PBX background? Cisco? Avaya, okay. Because certain terminology, I can correlate with that when we talk about the call routing. So when we have like a link deployment, it's really critical to have a sponsor during that project. If we look at that, based on my experience, what I have seen, there is already a PBX in the environment. And when you are talking about the link deployment, then there is always kind of people saying, okay, link is good for IAM presence, but when you go to enterprise wise, maybe there are some features that it cannot do. So we want to make sure we always have a, like a link sponsor, executive level sponsorship there. And once we have identified that, to make sure that we have certain goals set with that, we have a briefing, okay, what are the outcomes for this, if it's a pilot project or it's a deployment, what is the outcomes of that? To talk about the timelines, what the timelines we have on that, when the project gonna end, and what are the scope of this? It's IAM presence, conferencing, video conferencing, and all of that. So it's really critical to set that agenda ahead of time, because executive sponsor is the person who gonna have you all the time, make sure, okay, this is a successful deployment, things are going well, and he can give you, provide you all the feedback. So make sure you get that involved. Because I have seen, in my experience, a lot of the time when I was involved with the link projects, we have seen a lot of pushback from the networking team. I'm not sure about you guys. You see always they say, we don't know how the QoS going to be there, how the CAG gonna work, how the interop scenario is gonna happen, you know. There's a lot of pushback. And the other pushback, which I get a lot about security, right? Okay, how the, maybe you have to open so many ports for the link, how the link handles security aspect. So I would always say, get engaged with the networking team early, set the expectation, because those are the people who, you know, have the telecom budget, right? Who has the PBX budget. We are pretty good engaging with the desktop team, but when we are talking about the budget going, it goes more with the telecom team. So get those people engaged, address their concerns, and get them on board. And that's I have seen a lot getting successful, you know, with my experience, many projects. So that was the only, by the way, non-technical slide which we have discussing. No, we're going to talk about more about the link wise routing. Here are some chairs if you want to come here. Yeah. So in the WISE routing, if you, maybe you have seen this diagram a lot, especially if you guys came from the master rotation, we use this diagram a lot there whenever we talk about the car routing. But as I said, we are not covering location-based routing. This will be covered on the other side. So there are three portions in this diagram if you look at that. One is the user habits. The other you're going to see is more on the infrastructure side, the gateway. And third one is the when the call goes out to the PSTN and the endpoints, what happens on that. So going back to the user habits, when we plan to do a link deployment or we initiate a unified communications project or collaboration, it's really important to understand what the user habits are, right? People who are coming from OCS, link background, they're pretty used to right-click on the name and just do a call. The call goes fine. No issue with that, right? When I joined Microsoft, I don't have that kind of experience. So I was always thinking, okay, I'm going to dial 9 to go out or 8 to go out. Then I'm going to dial the number, right? That's the PBX, you know, the thing how it's going to go. And especially it depends where you are. Let's say you are in Toronto, you're going to have 10-digit number and then 9, right? It needs to be accounted for that. And if you are in North Carolina, you're going to dial the 7-digit number. If you are in Seattle, 10-digit. If you are in Germany somewhere, you have variable length of number. So these are the user habits. We want to make sure because we want to feed the link how the user dials the number and how it can be normalized, right? How it can be converted to E164 number. I will talk about E164 number in next slides, but the Microsoft best practice is to have the number converted to E164 number for many reasons. Right, and we will discuss about that. So we educate the link how to adopt the user behavior if they dial the 4-digit extension. Okay, how to convert into E164 number. So these are all the things we need to feed to the link through the process of normalization rules. If you look here in the diagram, like on the right-hand side, the CPU array. Let's say if a user dials a number, if he calls. If we click on a name and he dials it, then the call goes from one link user to the other link user, right? So then there is no like routing involved a lot, so it's a simple call. It should work, you know. Then we don't need to worry about E164. We don't need to worry about that. But what happens next? If somebody is dialing the emergency number, right? If he dials them, then that's fine. You're gonna see it's gonna see okay. The user dial the emergency number, let's route it to a different way, and it's going to go to that. However, if he dials a number that is, or maybe he doesn't click, he dials a number that is not an emergency number, but it's another like calling somebody outside to a PSTN, dialing an international number or something, then what happens, right? So we will discuss about that. Then the second portion, which you see in the center, then that comes into play, how the class of servers or restriction and all of that comes into play. We will discuss about that. So we talked about the E164 number, why it is important to convert if somebody dials the 4-digit extension, or if he's dialing 7-digit extension, RFP is dialing like 10-digit number, how it is important to convert into E164 because it's much easier down the road if we want to associate the dial plans, the WISE policies, and the PSTN usages, which I will explain what they are in the next slides, to associate them with the routes, with the gateways. It's much easier to do the routing for that as compared to if we are just, you know, like having any numbers, 5 or 10 digits on that. And also within the Active Directory, if we click, if we are like in an email or office, then it's much easier to dial, you know, right click and dial the E164 number. You don't need to type 9 or 8 or anything on that. It can be done much easier if they have E164 number. The federation, right? If you have, if you are working with other partners, you know, your organization is involved heavily with the customers or other, you know, partners, then you can dial the E164 number there easily. So it's not something that Link will not work without E164. There are ways to do that, but that's the best practice from Microsoft, that use the E164 number and convert the numbers to E164 before they can be routed on it. So here are the dial plans. What are actually the dial plans, right? These are the user habits which we discuss. If somebody dials 4-digit number or 7-digit number, how it can be normalized, how it can be converted to E164 number to make it routable to the outer world. So the dial plans can be assigned per user, per pool, per site, or global. How the preference works in that is, if you have a dial plans, if you have a user dial plan and a pool dial plan, so the user dial plan will always take preference on that, right? If you have a user dial plan and if you have a global dial plan, again, the user gonna take preference on it. That's how the precedence works. So at one time, only one type of dial plan gonna take preference on it. So giving just example here, if we look at the first dial plan, which has the pattern. So how it works is, like, if you see the small, you know, their sign, caret sign, what does it mean in dial plan? It starts with. So it's saying the pattern is the starts with 2, 3, and then followed by, you know, see the D signs, followed by 2 digits. It's going to come the 2 digits. And the translation, it becomes this +44207930 and then $1. It means whatever you have here, pattern to match, bring that number and make the complete number +44207930 and then the 4 digit. That's we use a lot to get the full number into E164 and normalize. It's a little bit tricky. I'm not sure how many of you have used it before, but when you get used to, accustomed to, then I think it gets much easier. And when you are involved in a lot of deployments, then you have, like, your inventory, and you do cut and paste based on what you do. It gets much easier. In the beginning, a little bit, you know, playing, I don't know how many people you do scripting or all of that. It was pretty new for me, coming from the Cisco world, too. I was doing more different type of call routing, but it took a while. Then I think it makes sense. So now, going back again here to the voice routing. So we talked about the user habits, how we can educate the link. If a user dials different type of 4 or 7 digit, how it can be normalized. Now the second thing comes. If a user dials a number to the outer world, right? Let's say I am a link user, and I want to dial a Toronto number, 416-854-XXX, right? If I dial that number, what happens then, right? So it leaves the link, you know, link world, and then it's going to go through the gateway or SIP trunking, whatever we are using, and it's going to go out. Then there are many things to consider. For example, class of service, class of restrictions, that whether that user has permission to dial that number or no, right? So this another way to educate the gateways and the voice policies and the infrastructure how to deal with the number. That is the second portion in the link, which we talk a lot about. You know, here we will discuss what these are. So let's go one by one here. By the way, before I go to the next slide and we discuss about the, you know, the class of service and what are the voice policies, any questions here so far? So I also have, like, you know, the Skype cards here, the gifts to give if somebody asks a question. I don't know if it's going to be left for you or no, but... Yeah. Still, I think I should give it to you. Yeah. Okay. So at the high level, the WISE policies, these are the class of service or user authorization, right? So some people within the organization, they say they can dial anywhere, like CEOs or executives, they can dial a premium number, they can dial international, they can dial everywhere. So we create the different WISE policies for different type of people. And then it's called like also classes. So if you came from like the Cisco background here, so it's the calling search space. That is equivalent to WISE policies, we call it calling search space. And then there is a PSTN usages, right? So PSTN usages, what it does is you assign the PSTN usage to WISE policy because there you say, okay, PSTN usage, how I consider it is like local usage, international usage, national usage, premium usage. So we have these usages assigned to WISE policies, right? And then these PSTN usages are connected to the routes, right? So they have, it's kind of glue, PSTN usage is a glue between WISE policy and routes. If PSTN use, if they are not associated, they are nothing, right? So you cannot use it. So we will see in next couple of slides the scenarios where you can see how they can be configured, right? And how we can best use them. Because call routing is the core, by the way. That is the one thing, if we design it properly within the organization, it's much easier to add more call routing, add more sites onto that. If it's done properly, it's scalable, and you don't need to reinvent the wheel all the time if you do that well. And here you can see the on the right-hand side, on the routes, so the routes can be associated with multiple PSTN usages, right? We will look into the scenarios on that. And the same with the WISE policies. So WISE policies can also be associated with multiple PSTN usages. Just giving a more maybe explanation about the WISE policies. Again, as we discussed in the dial plan, that WISE policies can be assigned per user, site, global, or based on the pool, right? So if...
That is something which can be defined at the link level as well as at the gateway level. What's your take on that?
Right. Right. So the dial plan, these are actually the patterns, you do the normalization is done based on the dial plan, right? But when you want to assign it, right, you assign the WISE policies and PSTN usage and the routes on that. Then you do that, right? So this is done for the normalization. You can do it. Then you associate with that on the routes, the patterns. You associate that on routes. And then I have a couple of slides that will explain also the trunks, where we say you can do that at the higher level rather than going to the gateway. In 2013, now we have the capability of using the multiple trunks, right? Yeah. So, yeah, I will explain that where you can see what are the benefits if you assign that on the trunk and do all the translation patterns there.
Yeah. So user override site, which overall yeah. Global.
This is for you. Thank you.
So the reason I asked is because in my company half of it is done by link side and the other half is done by the
gateway. Right. So it really depends when we are talking about the dial plan. So we look at the bigger picture, right? What we want to achieve, where our locations are, right? If we are a global organization, right, so where it makes sense to be on the, is it on the site or global or what you want to achieve on that? So once we have all those requirements there, then we can see, okay, we can do the site level normally based on that. That can be done, right? And again, it is a WISE policy that you need to assign, right? And the patterns are just part of that get things normalized. Sorry, you were asking a question? Right. Yeah. So the question was the WISE policies, how the precedence level work. Like, let's say you have a WISE policy for user, for site, and global, all three, right, there. So who's going to do that? So the user going to have higher precedence, right? So let's say you have two WISE policies, user or site, so user going to get higher preference. So user going to take effect that. If you, even you have site, it will not take effect. So user going to take effect of that.
And that's a pretty universal concept. It's not specific to voice policies in particular.
The same, the other PBX vendors does the same thing, And any other you think like we can assign the WISE policies other than the people? We are talking about, let's say, giving somebody international, national, local, and all of that. Do we feel any other place it can be assigned to WISE policies where they are useful? Sorry? Other than users, Exactly. So the common area phone, especially, let's say I go into the office, then you have a lobby there, right? And then the lobby, you cannot give them international access because everybody can dial that, right? So it's more common to conference room or the lobby, you give them local or emergency so they can do that. So that's possible. And the other is the flexibility which we have about the WISE policies. Also, we have, we can decide the features like call forwarding, where we want to give, right? Based on that, whether we want to give delegation, call transfer, simultaneous ring. So we can also assign based on the users, right? This is all part of the WISE policy. The call routing and also this flexibility we have, we can give it to site or per user, or global, whatever we want to do, we can do that. Again, it's recommended based on your, you know, the requirements, maybe go per site, right? And then some users, which you want to treat specially, then give them special WISE policies, which you want to, so they can override, right? So everybody else will get the site, and only those users will get that. So they will do that. Call forwarding and simultaneous ring. In Link 2010, right? So there was something we were not able to do. That if somebody has international permission to dial an international number, right? So he can get the call forwarding a simultaneous ring. But here, no. In Link 2013, we can say if even somebody has a only a he can dial like the, let's say the national dialing, so he can still get the simultaneous. We have more granular level PSTN usages here in simultaneous ring now. Now, if you look at that, we have WISE policy PSTN usages. By the way, I don't think I explained a lot about the PSTN usages, but that's going to come the next slide. What the PSTN usage again does is that it, it's these are basically the, your keys. If you have a lock and you have different keys, so for the national, you have a key. For the international, you have a key. And then for the local, you have a key. You put those keys, you can dial in, right? So here in Link 2013, we have the capability to have customized simultaneous ring PSTN usages, right? No, you can assign in such a way to the users in the simultaneous ring that if a person has a national, like if you look at the slide here, so if somebody has, they can have route to internal link users only. So they can get the simultaneous ring on that. And also they can route using custom PSTN users. Here we can define granular level if somebody has only national and he can get the simultaneous ring. He doesn't need to be international because this, sorry, go ahead.
So if you have a simultaneous ring and somebody answers one of the endpoints.
Right. Right.
Is it dropped off? Once, once it's answered, is that the only endpoint?
Sure. The question is if the simultaneous ring is active and if it rings the phone, either your desk phone or your cell phone, if you pick up one phone, what happens to the other call? So whatever you pick, other get terminated. That's it. So only one time you you get that.
So
once you pick up the phone, one you have, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Likes to start meetings from her phone, put it on hold, and then tell him it's ready. He can't go to a conference phone and just hit the line and it's ready to go.
Right.
There,
so
there are methods of achieving that, but specifically simultaneous ring is not the way you do it.
Okay. Simultaneous ring is not the best way for that. It is good for, like, the people, let's say, I don't want to advertise my cell phone number. and I just give one number on my business card. And if somebody dials like 9 to 6, they call it. If I am even there during that time, I can pick up my cell too. But after 6 o'clock, it will go to the voicemail. So you have. It's up to you. It's based on your number of chats. So the question is how many endpoints we can program for simultaneous. So this is something capability. You get it on the number of PRIs, you know, the channels you have or the SIP trunking you are using. So based on that, you plan and you also see how many channels you have. And based on that, you can see, okay, how many I don't want to give it to everybody, right? So because it's going to take your one channel. So you can do based on your PSTN capacity or SIP trunking capacity. So the PSTN usage here, which I think we explained in the previous slide a little bit here more, is that this is a glue between the WISE policy and the routes, right? So it needs to be assigned. We need to have PSTN usage within WISE policies, and the routes needs to be associated with that. Otherwise, it's nothing. You know, if it's not assigned to anything, it's not going to work, right? And these... we will see now in the next slide, I think, here, the route, right? So a WISE route associate destination phone number. So now we have... Sure.
So in the voice policy, is that where the users are? PSTN would be where the phones are, and routes is just kind of where actually the route pattern it's going to choose for the outbound call.
Right. So in the next slide, I will show you how the call flow happens. I have some examples there. So I will be able to show you, okay, when you dial a number, what happens, you know, in the WISE policy, maybe, yeah, I will cover that there. So the route, so we discussed three components. We said for the infrastructure perspective, we have the WISE policy, we have the PSTN usage, and then we have the routes, right? So these are the routes needs to be associated with PSTN usage to work for that. So we have WISE policy, let's say, just giving an example for a user A has a WISE policy. And that user A has a PSTN usage where he can call, right? So once he get, okay, I can call here, and then there are the routes there, then using that routes and those routes has the gateway associated. So based on that, we have the gateway and he can call outside. And I was talking about the E164 before. So now you can see here on the right-hand side how easy it is if you have E164 number to program like +31, and then you put an exception there. And it's much easier to associate the gateways when you have all E164 number. Otherwise, it's going to be a little bit challenging. Okay, we're going to have 9 or 8 or all of that. How are we going to associate the gateways with that? So controlling gateway preferences, right? So the multiple trunks in the same route. If we have, we know we have done the WISE policies, we have PSTN usages, we have now the routes, and we want to have multiple gateways. If we have multiple gateways within the same route, right? Then if we have two gateways, it can take any of that. If I call, let's say, call to Frankfurt, right? And if my policy is gonna check, user gonna check, okay, this guy is allowed to call international. When it is calling to international, then it's gonna see, okay, I have PSTN usage international, it will let me go, and then it will look at the routes, right? From the routes, then it will look what gateways are associated with that on that trunk, right? And when there are two gateways associated with that, it can take any of that, right? So we will see how we can make sure which gateway it should take always. There are mechanisms which we can do, but I am just giving you a couple of scenarios that how is it possible. If we don't do that, it can take any of that, right? And we will have some examples in the next slide that I will explain. And then you can have multiple routes in the same usage. This is, again, a scenario we will test it. And routes in different usages, right? So if we want that we use a specific gateway. Let's say I use a specific gateway, go to the Frankfurt or go to the, you know, to the anywhere in India or Dubai, then there are ways we need to configure. And we have a special order of PSTN usages within the WISE policy, which we need to have there. So let's take example. So here is the, hopefully it will answer your questions while I will cover that. So we have a WISE policy. Let's say there's a Seattle WISE policy. Now you can see the PSTN usage. Let's say the user has the site has that internal usage, local usage, and then you have Seattle National, Seattle International, and last resort usage, right? By the way, it's really important to have a meaningful names for the PSTN usages, because if you say PSTN usage 1, PSTN usage 2, usage 3, it will still work. However, if you want to scale down the road, if you want to do that, then it will be pretty challenging for you. Let's say he places a call 206-555-1212. So on the right-hand side, if you look at that, there are a number of the routes associated with these PSTN usages, right? So we were talking about the routes associated with that. So you have WISE policy, then you have the PSTN usage there, then you have the right-hand side, you have the routes there. And then the routes points to the gateways. Let's eliminate first, if you dial that number, what are the possibilities? Which the routes it will pick? So these are the only possibilities it's going to take. The reason is, if you see 206.555, it have the gateway 3 there. It's going to match the pattern. So this was the pattern which we created there before. So it's going to match that. And it's going to say, okay, I can take the 206 plus 206, because these are all possible things which can happen. Anybody knows why it picked number 5? It was a first match, right? And somebody else said something too? Closest match, right? Okay. So by the way, the interesting thing is it's going to pick because it was the first one, right? Normally, I also working with a PBX, I thought, okay, it's going to get the closest match that makes more sense, right? But if that number 5 going to happen to number 12, it's going to pick that one, right? So there are ways how we can make sure which it picks, but this is it's going to pick right now. The first one, whichever it got, right?
Does that mean it picks the first one in the list? So once it picks one that matches, it doesn't...
First it's going to... Yeah. Pick the best route out of the list? Right. So first of all, it's going to pick the... It must match the dial pattern, right? It must match the dial pattern. So it's going to ignore all of that are not matching it, right? And then it's going to pick the first one, whichever is matching that. It's going to do that. And you're going to see how we can change it if we want. The other number, if you see here, if you're dialing 312-666, again, you have multiple. It must match the pattern first, right? So if you look at right-hand side, let's eliminate what is possible. So only these are the things possible here which can happen, right? Again, it's going to go with 312 because, again, this is the first one there. It's the closest match. Let's say if gateway 1 is down, right? If gateway 1 is down, then it's going to go to the gateway 2. And if gateway 1 and gateway 2 both are down, then it's going to go to the gateway 3, right? So it's going to go automatically based on that.
What about if channels are all gateway 1, gateway 2?
Right. Right, yeah. Yeah, so it all depends how we configure that. Either it's all busy, it's gonna route to the next one. Yeah. Yes. Right. So it based on how many gateways we are putting there, and if the capacity overflow, what mechanism we want to have there, it overflows to the SIP trunk if that is the next one, in there, or if it is the next gateway, it will do that. So if it's the overflow, yeah. Yeah, yeah, and we make him understand, right? Yeah, we put in the list all of that.
So I understand it's going to the next gateway, but does it still need to match the pattern?
Yeah, first it has to match the pattern, right? So if gateway is down, then it's gonna go. So it's first thing it did, it matches the pattern. So it knows who gateways it has on that, right? So the first thing it matches the pattern, and then it's gonna go to the next.
So, so, so can
Yeah, if gateway 1 and gateway 2 are not down, it will never go to there. Yeah, or if it's overflow, which there was a question on that. Yeah. Right.
Right.
Exactly.
If all the gateways in that route are busy, it moves to the next pattern.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on how the
it moved to pattern 7 in that case or pattern 4? Because 4 is next in
the list. No, it's already matched the pattern.
Okay.
Right.
So the pattern matching is
it's done once. Once you have it, it's already done the pattern matching and it's going to go to the next one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm actually running a little bit out of time, but I just to like there are two I think more slides than I think Tim want to come. So the trunks, right? So trunk is in Link 2013. Now we have multiple. We can have multiple trunks. So trunk is association between the mediation server and the listening port, and again PSTN gateway and listening port, right? So that's really a good feature now we have. We can do a lot of things here with the scalability perspective. So we can have, on the trunk level, we can do a lot of, which I think was the question, if we want to do play, you know, with the numbers translation, we can do at the trunk level instead of going to the gateway side. We can do a lot of that. And other thing here is the, you know, the features on the right-hand side, you can see encryption level, it is supported or no, right? And also you can see it's media passes. So we have to make sure before enabling this feature whether they are supported on the gateway or no. If it's an enhanced gateway, if you look, you see OIP list, it can support. Otherwise, like special refer call transfer, it will not support if it's not supported on the gateway. If you're using a Cisco gateway, then you are, if you're talking about encryption like SLTP, you know, and then we are doing TLS, that there's a cipher mismatch, it's not going to happen. So it will not be supported. It's really important to make sure the gateway which we are using, it is enhanced or know what it can support before checking this, check or uncheck that. And here is the, you know, how you can manage on the trunk level, how we can make sure we can have like a translation pattern created on that instead of going on each gateway we control on the trunk level. We create the translation patterns there. Let's say if somebody is dialing one number and then the gateway failed, then it can go back from another gateway, but we need to make sure that we have properly, you know, on the trunk level, we have created the translation pattern to match it, right?
Does this bypass the class of service or the route rules? Translation rules after the route?
We are checking it first, right? This is the trunk, you know, this there are different types of trunks. So what we do is first voice policy, we have PSTN usage, right? And then we have the routes. And these are the trunks at the route level which I am talking about, and then these are associated with the gateways.
But trunks are after the route is already calculated, so they call the net
route. Right.
So when I go to the trunk, for example, if I notice if I'm not supposed to make an international call, however, I have a translation rule there that someone had 0.7.
Right. Yeah, because we in the voice policy we are making sure what you are entitled you can do it. Otherwise, no, you will not be able to do that.
If you've reached this point, it's already been determined that you can route internationally, and now it's doing the prefix that the gateway needs to get out and do that.
Well, there are some people they don't dial 0.11 in the link line, so they're saying add 0.11. And one way to do it is to have it here at the trunk level, which means that you're bypassing the passive service.
Okay, so we can.
All you're doing here is giving the gateway what it needs to then send a call up.
So it, this is the.
By the way, we have maybe a half an hour after the session.
We can take the question because this is not the trunk which maybe there is one is SIP trunking, that is totally different thing, and this is the trunk which is associated with the gateways which we are talking about. But we can talk that. You know, in the deeper discussion, if we need to, we can do. But all the class of service and everything is done there, you know, before that. Okay, I will let know the team to come, and I think it's
thank you.
It's here now. Yeah. Sorry about a little bit. I was.
Oh, my goodness. So before I jump into this, just coming back to that about, you know, we will be available after the session offline to deep dive on some of the stuff too. And for anybody that wants to get a little deeper into some of these topics, there's actually, if you're not familiar, there's a lot of great resources out there. One of the ones that I went to when I was trying to learn this stuff a while back was Microsoft Virtual Academy. If you've never been on there, there's a great track for Link Voice on there. They go through a lot of demonstrations, examples, they're configuring servers, walking through call flows on there, very, very detailed. It's hours and hours, right? So you'll spend a lot of time in there, but if you need and want to get to the next level of understanding about how this stuff works, that is a great resource. So shifting gears, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the Link call handling services. Zahid talked about routing, and these are some of the voice applications that are on board the Link server. And I'm going to focus on four of them, response groups, unassigned number, call park, and group call pickup. We'll talk about what each of these are as we go and discuss some of the, you know, the deployment considerations, how these things get set up, some of the different options for how they work. So let's start with the response group service. And what the response group service is basic call distribution functionality, right? It's for applications like routing to receptionist or help desk, small scale queuing where there might be multiple incoming calls that need to be terminated, need to be answered, and then potentially rerouted from there. But on a small to medium scale, right? And the feature for this, the services for this are installed with Enterprise Voice. So when in Topology Builder, when you deploy your servers and you set up for Enterprise Voice, the service is already there on the front ends, and it's licensed as part of Enterprise Voice through the Link Plus Cal. And these are server-side media applications, right, that, as I just mentioned. Let's talk about what they aren't, because this is pretty important to keep in mind. These are not full-scale call center applications when you set up response groups, right? So there are a lot of really terrific features of call centers that, you know, whether it's being able to listen in on calls or supporting Whisper or really advanced metrics on what's going on in the queues, what are the average wait times, there are a lot of great tools and monitoring out there in some call center applications. We're not attempting to solve for that here. And if those are your needs, there's a lot of folks downstairs on the expo floor that would love to talk to you about their call center solutions. This is a much more limited, you know, if the needs of your department, if the needs of your group are met by the response group service, that's terrific, deploy it. If they're not, we don't recommend shoehorning larger, more complex needs in on top of response group, because it's not going to work for you in the long term. So that's my, there's two primary applications, that's one of them, and we'll talk about those in a second. The other limitation to it to keep in mind is that there's not a whole lot of programmability behind it. There is some configuration, we'll talk about what that configuration is, but you're not going to do database dips, right? You're not going to be able to implement things like, let's say you run a pharmacy and you want to do prescription refill, or I want to get status on my order and I have to punch in my order number and I'll go get a record from a SQL database or something. That capability is not there. Right, this is very, very static kinds of configurations that allow you to deposit people into the proper location, into the proper queue, so that their call can be answered.
Yeah. So just to, in other words, if you're looking like full-fledged call center solution, the response groups are not the solution.
Well, let's talk about what they are a solution for, right? And when you're setting up response groups, there's really three primary configurations that you're going to need to step through. When you look at it inside of inside of the configuration in the Link server, they actually sort of appear in reverse order. So if you've never done this before, the first time you step through, if you're like me, you want to work from left to right in terms of the configuration tabs. You actually got to start on the right and work your way back left. And I don't know why that is, but it's just a fact that you should keep in mind the first time you go to do this. First thing you want to do is set up your groups. And these are your lists of agents, and they can be assigned individually or with distribution lists so that you can have a level of abstraction there so that people can get added in without having to come back and manage the group later. There are participation policies, whether they're informal or formal. Informal is, at least in my experience, the applications that I've seen the most. Users get assigned to groups, you sign into the Link client, and you're automatically active in that response group, able to receive calls coming off of that queue. Formal is, as it states, it's a much more structured way of participating in the group. You have to actually go to the the web console and register for that group when you're ready to start taking calls. It's not automatically happening as a result of just being signed in and available inside a link. There's a number of routing methods, and just to give you an example of a couple of them, you know, and for starter, with minor exceptions, all these things are presence availability based. So if users are busy in general, except in the case of I believe Parallel, users who are said as busy are not going to get incoming calls. And it's just a matter of what your preference is. Longest idle, round robin, serial, where it's always the same person that gets the call first. And maybe, you know, consideration for that type of setup is that I've got a primary receptionist, but there's other people that sort of back them up when they have multiple calls coming in that they can't field. If there's only a single call sitting in the queue, I always want it to go to that person, but anything that comes in sort of overloads her, they go off to someone else that sort of backs that person up. That's an application for something like Serial. And the alert time configuration is just a matter of determining how long do I sit and wait on whichever party that I'm trying to contact before I go back into the group and try the next one in the list.
So it's not like the most available, it's more like a top-down type of...
It's kind of whatever you want it to be. We can ring everybody, we can ring one designated person first all the time and then fail back. We can do a pure round robin, we can do the one that has been available or idle for the longest time, whatever your needs are there. So those are the groups that are servicing the calls coming off of the queue. Now it's time to manage the queue itself. We need to configure the queues, and this is where the calls go while they're waiting to be answered. And a couple of important things to keep in mind when you're configuring that is the queue timeout. This is the maximum amount of time that a person can sit in the queue before some other action has to happen, right? So you don't want unless you're the airline that I flew out on the other day, you generally don't want people to rot in the queue for too long before you move them off to somewhere else that somebody may be able to help them. And then the action that you want to take after that timeout period occurs, right? We can either move them over to another queue, some other group that's backing them up. You could, you know, send them to a designated URI or phone number. Heck, you can even disconnect. I can't for the life of me understand why you would want to do that, but
unless you're the airline
I flew out on the other day.
There's a question on top.
There is a question, yes. There is a, so the question is, what does the caller hear? So we're going to look here. I think I have a couple of settings on a forward page, but let's just talk about it here. There is a designated announcement that they can hear. And then there is a configurable music on hold so that while they're sitting in the queue waiting to be answered, that there's at least some comfort music or something that you record ahead of time for them to listen to. So that was queue timeout. How do we make sure people don't rot in the queue? Then there's queue overflow. We've got too many people waiting in line, and what happens when that absolute limit is exceeded? And the actions that you can take are similar to the timeout. Do we just dump people off like the airline, or do we send them somewhere else or offer them some other treatment in that case? And then from there we get into the workflows. And again, think of these in reverse order, and we're going to look at an example that sort of comes in reverse order in a moment, but I wanted to take you through sort of the configuration flow. The workflows are sort of the actions that happen when the user dials in. The first one, as you asked, is a basic hunt group. There's a recorded greeting, and depending upon time of day or holiday, there is basic routing and queuing based on the assigned queues for that workflow. The other one is a little bit more robust, complicated application, an IVR, essentially. And this is potentially up to a two-tier IVR with custom messages, opportunities to prompt users for input with DTMF or voice, and to interpret that feedback coming back from the user and potentially route them into different queues or to different URIs based on those responses. And these three things in sort of I think this is new to 2013, in a 2010 deployment are generally just managed by the response group administrator. It's one Uber administrator that was responsible for everything related to response groups. What we've introduced in 2013 is the notion of a response group manager. You can take individual users inside of your organization and assign them responsibility over specific workflows. So you're the business manager for the help desk, and you want to make sure that the settings and the policies and the membership of the people that are taking calls on the help desk are as you need them to be, but without then having access to administration over different queues, right? So this sort of illustrates the flow of how calls come in. Users dial a number or a URI that's attached to a response group. They land in the flow, depending upon what you define. At some point, they take a couple of actions. They get deposited into a queue, and at some point, one of the members of the agent group takes the call off the queue. On the left, we have sort of the managed case where we have an individual that's responsible for supporting that individual queue. And the difference between what you see on the left and on the right is because these managed queues on the left, there's responsibility within that particular work group, like the help desk example I just gave. There isn't the flexibility to reuse the queues and the agent groups across multiple flows, across multiple workflows, right? If you're in an unmanaged environment, you can actually take those configurations that you've built and sort of line them up across different workflows. And one of the applications of that was the example we gave earlier about, you know, the timeout occurs or the overflow happens. Somebody's been sitting there too long. There's an alternate queue we may be able to put them in. We should send them over to another destination so that group can pick them up. But that only works if you've configured that workflow as unmanaged. A couple of questions here.
How would, if you assign a workflow to be managed, how would they manage that? What interface would you use? Just like a control panel?
Yeah, they go through the web UI to manage that. There's a response group web UI. I'm going to give you the mic and the pointer here and just let you take over. Yeah, so the question, let me boil that down a little bit. You have an unmanaged environment, but if you had them managed, would you be able to do things like on a snow day, would other people inside your organization, your designated managers, be able to adjust sort of the working hours so that different actions kicked in sort of out of schedule? And the answer is yes.
Yeah.
And one last question here. No, it can be one to many. One person can be in multiple groups.
Yeah. It depends, yeah, if you want to give that.
And it's very powerful. It can also get you into trouble if you're clumsy about how you set it up. And so it's something to be, you know, if it's something that you're going to do, be mindful of it. If it's a managed group, you're not going to be able to do that. And last thing on response groups is the notion of agent anonymity. And I just put up sort of a quick flow here to illustrate the case where, you know, there are certain applications where it's okay for the agent that answers the call to be known. Perhaps, you know, sort of like an internal corporate help desk where it's all right that the person who's calling the help desk find out the name and phone number of the person that answered the call. But for other cases, it's very much a bad idea. Right, so just to sort of lay out the flow of how this works, a caller dials into the help desk. That call routes through the response group service. It rings out to Agent Bob based on whatever our queuing mechanism is, and the caller sees that they're talking to this response group service while Agent Bob is trying to decide whether to answer the call or not. If the workflow is set up to be anonymous, when Bob answers that call, Alice is still going to see that conversation as being with the response group service, and he's an anonymous agent behind the response group talking through it out to the caller. The alternative to that is that the response group service gets out of the way in this conversation because the administrator is perfectly happy with the callers knowing the identity of the person that answered the call, And once Bob accepts that call, Alice can see who that is. The obvious pros and cons here: one, anonymity makes sure that your people that are on the list, you know, maybe they're not getting pinged by people weeks later like, hey, I have a new problem and you were really helpful and I'd like you to just work on it for me. On the flip side, you know, if anonymity is not important, you can gain a lot more scalability out of your environment because you don't have calls and media routing through your response group service anymore. Question. So the question is, how are they anonymous? So as a caller, right, let's say you're from a Link client inside the company, you call the help desk. Anonymity in the sense that even after somebody picks up that call, you still see that you're talking to the help desk. You don't know the identity, the URI, the phone number of the person that's sitting behind it. I mean, he can certainly self-identify to you, but it's not revealed to you through caller ID or the remote party identity. Okay, the next thing, the next service I want to talk about is the unassigned number service. And this is really what happens for calls that are coming into numbers that are owned by the enterprise but aren't necessarily assigned to users right now, right? And if we don't have a service available here, then what's going to happen is people are just going to get a fast busy because the number doesn't route to anybody, right? And in a lot of cases, that's a bad experience that companies want to avoid. So what the unassigned number service allows you to do is play an announcement and then transfer that call off to some pre-configured destination, whether it be a voicemail server, it could be a queue somewhere, a SIP URI, a voicemail, whatever. You can even set it up that all it does is play an announcement that this line isn't in service, disconnect the call, right? It at least gives you an experience that's better than busy, right? And the way you set that up is you start by creating an announcement message, and that can be either text-to-speech that you specify through configuration, as is in this example here, or you can upload a WAV file to the file store, point to it from the configuration that contains whatever audio message that you want played in that case. Next thing you're going to want to do is set up a target URI for forwarding, if forwarding is desired, if you don't just want to disconnect action after that message is played. And really, that's it. It's pretty straightforward. The only thing you want to keep in mind is when you're, you know, you obviously you have to define the applicable number range. I left that step out. But the thing you want to remember is make sure that you're only defining ranges for this unassigned number service, only assign them for ranges that are owned by Link. Right? Because what's going to happen, go back to Zahid's sort of call routing picture up there, what's going to happen if you do that wrong is all the attempts of your Link users to call out to somebody that's on the PBX are going to get dumped in the unassigned number service because it's not something that's owned by Link. So you do want to be careful about how you set that up and be mindful about your number ranges. Yes? You can have multiple ranges, subsets of ranges, and you just want to make sure for the users that are, and however those numbers got assigned, right? Sometimes it's very clean and sometimes it's ugly how they got allocated, right? You just want to make sure that for all the ranges where you do want to capture that they're configured in one range or another. It's very dependent upon how your numbers got allocated. That's right. Absolutely. That's right. If it's assigned to a user, Zahid's picture takes over, yeah, and it routes off to the user. This only defines what happens when you have that E164 number that you own, but there's no user attached to it. That's the only situation where this kicks in. I'm sure there is at some point. I'm not sure what the number is.
Yeah, I think there will be, but we are not sure how much. Yeah. Maybe we can check that for you.
There's an upper limit to everything. I just don't know what it is.
Yeah. Oh, that should be fine.
That's not problematic.
That should be fine. Yeah. No. We are talking about 100,000 or 10, or maybe, yeah. That should be fine, too. Yeah.
Let's plow ahead here. And if we could, let's hold off questions till the end. I want to make sure there's a couple of important topics that I want to talk about here before we wrap up. Next is the call park service. And call park is, as I think everybody is familiar with call park, you're in a call, you want to transfer that to some other place, right? But active, attended, or unattended transfer is not the appropriate solution, right? You either want to, you know, maybe one example where you want to transfer it to yourself, I'm at my desk, I want to talk to you from a conference room now, so this is sort of a soft way of transferring to myself. I hit call park, I hang the phone up, I run into that conference room, I dial in the park orbit number, and pick up my call there. The other common possibility is that I need to transfer it to somebody who's sort of on the go and doesn't have really a designated number or SIP URI. It's somebody that is constantly in motion, and you just want them to be able to pick up the call wherever it is they're located. And they can pick it up from anywhere that can route back to Link, right? So the only endpoints that can park are the Link clients that understand the protocols to be able to go to the call park service. These are your Link clients, your Link IP phones that we're going to talk about here in a few minutes. But any phone in the network that can dial that #123 can retrieve that off of that. It could be an Avaya phone. It could be just about anything, as long as it's inside of your domain. There's a ringback that happens, so that if nobody ever picks up the call, the user doesn't just, the person that's on hold doesn't just disappear. And then there's a transfer fallback destination in the event that the ringback fails as well, so that there's one last chance to send that person somewhere where they can be helped in the event that everybody lets them down. In terms of configuration, just like with response group services is installed when you set up enterprise voice, you enable it in the user policy. You probably missed it when Zahid was showing some of the policy settings, but call park was one of them. It was not checked. It is not checked by default. So if you want to set this up for your users, you do need to enable it. It's not something that they're going to get automatically when you turn enterprise voice on. Excuse me. And once you've enabled it for the users, you configure the orbit ranges, right? And there's only a couple of minor considerations to keep in mind when you're setting those up. Typically, people are prefixing them with something like a pound or a star. It's not mandatory, but it is an easy way to sort of designate a set of numbers that are assigned for this. Some additional settings for call park that you can control if you choose to: music on hold, the number of ringback attempts. Again, all these have defaults, but I'm gonna burn through them a little bit quicker here. What is the ringback timeout? So how long do I have to sit on the park orbit before I try to go back to the person that parked me initially? And then what is my fallback destination? The default fallback destination is null, which means after the designated timeout and ringback attempts are expired, the user just gets disconnected. So Tim's Airline has all these things set to default. And from a call flow point of view, I know we don't want to do ladder diagrams unless it's a 400 level class here, but the initial call setup, we're going through the Link front end server to Bob. Bob chooses explicitly to park that call back on the Link server, presses the button, and that call then gets terminated at the Link front end, and the media is now passing between the caller and the Link front end server, the call park service. Bob gets back a notification saying this is your orbit number, conveys that orbit number to whoever needs to pick it up, however he chooses to do so. And then Charlie dials that #199 from the other endpoint, and voila, he's connected to the original caller. And then the last scenario here I want to talk about before we get to devices is group call pickup. This is very similar in terms of architecture and setup to call park. It's riding on the back of that service. And let's talk about the scenario for a moment. Group call pickup is the ability for someone in a designated work group to intercept an incoming call for a user to make sure that a call doesn't go unanswered, right? So Zahid and I are part of a designated group call pickup group. Someone calls Zahid, he's away from his desk, we're part of a sales team, we never let a call go unanswered, it's critical, right? So he's not answering, and I can hear that it's on the fourth or fifth ring, I'm going to dial #123, whatever his designated number is, and that call now gets delivered to me, and I can pick it up and take care of that for him. It's basically using the call park infrastructure, the call park configurations, with the exception of this guy, the SIFA util here at the bottom, to deliver that capability. And the important thing to keep in mind with this SIFA util application is that this makes it not user manageable. A lot of these SIMO-ring or forwarding or team call things can be set and managed by the user inside of their link client. This specific service has to be managed by the administrator. So this is not something, at least in a lot of enterprises, you see deployed a lot. You know, the places where it is deployed, it's very limited, very constrained. It needs to be managed by the admin. Okay, so that's the services. Let's talk just for a couple of minutes about devices. And I'm not going to talk about USB headsets or peripherals like that because they're pretty straightforward. You plug them into your PC and off you go, right? I mean, there's more to it than that in building them and having a great experience. But in terms of deployment, that's how it works. IP phones are a little bit different of an animal. And we've got IP phones that are qualified for Link from five of our partners today. And they fall into two categories in terms of how they became qualified IP phones. The first is the quote-unquote optimized IP phones. And these are the devices that are running Link Phone Edition. Link Phone Edition is the phone experience that Microsoft developed. We shipped it with cooperation of our partners onto their IP phones. And this was sort of our original phone platform for partners, if you will. And for the scenarios that it was designed for and delivers, we believe it does it very well, right? And it provides a very integrated sort of sign-in experience. It makes sure that there's close cooperation, if set up properly, between the IP phone and the desktop. There's integration with Exchange so that you can do very simple meeting join, right? These are typical knowledge worker scenarios, someone that's sitting at a desk that does a lot of conferencing, does a lot of sort of PC-centric work. The phone is sort of designed and the experience is designed to complement that. And for the specific use cases where it was designed for, it's very effective. Compatible phones are a completely different beast. These are devices which the software on which has been built, coded, designed by our partners, the entire stack top to bottom. There's no Microsoft code in these things. Our partners, with the help from Microsoft, with the help of the product team, made their implementations compatible with Link, right? And there are, I believe, somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 unique SKUs from partners that we have in this category today. So partners develop it with help from Microsoft, and we put them through a qualification process to make sure that they meet minimum bars of functionality and quality. The advantage of devices in this category is that our partners control the feature sets, the form factors, the release schedules. They're not dictating scenarios or capabilities from Microsoft, who owns the software, right? So all of our partners are free to go and innovate and build experiences around whatever use case they deem to be important. So we mandate certain core capabilities that they all have to enable. Just as one of my examples is that they have to have a full ICE stack implementation so that these devices can work no matter where they're deployed, outside the firewall, inside. It's a core tenant of Link, and all the phones that we qualify have to adhere to that as well. It's just one example. But for these devices, you know, some of the extended scenarios that we have inside of Link Phone Edition and the optimized devices, they're optional. Right? It depends on what the partner's trying to achieve. They may choose to not implement certain capabilities, like tethering with the PC for a certain type of phone. Let me go back for a moment. Right? There are examples on this page, something that might be a lobby phone or something that you put in a kitchen, like the Snome 300 over here, or these decked handsets or one of the Wi-Fi handsets from SpectraLink. There's just certain capabilities that we feel are important for knowledge worker desk phones that in certain use cases, certain environments just aren't that important, right? On the flip side, they have the ability to innovate in terms of form factor, speed dial buttons, programmable keys that don't exist in Link Phone Edition. And the reason why I'm drawing this distinction for you is, as customers, I think it's important to remember these distinctions, because When you're making a selection of what type of phone you want to deploy, it's important to understand those differences, right? And one of the things you want to keep in mind is something that we're going to be doing a better job reflecting in TechNet in the very near future. The product group is doing an update of the TechNet pages for for these IP phones to make sure that we draw out these distinctions a little bit better. But depending upon when a device may have been qualified through our program, as we've gone through the years since this program kicked off, certain capabilities have been introduced, certain things have been made mandatory, that any device that sort of follows in that qualification must meet that criteria for it to pass, right? And what you'll see is any device that was qualified in, say, the past 12 months, it was mandatory for it to have full data center resiliency as we define it in Link, right? Some of the earlier devices that may not have been refreshed in some time may lack some of these newer things that are down the list. We haven't done a great job of drawing these distinctions in TechNet in the past, and keep an eye on that because this is something that we're going to improve upon. But as you can see, as the program's matured, devices in this compatible category have actually gotten a lot richer. The capabilities in terms of, you know, just as an example, signing in with an extension and PIN was something that we didn't initially require. Now all the devices in our program are required to and are able to do it. One of the key remaining gaps in terms of what we require is QoE. And this is something that, you know, if you're evaluating devices with your partners, this is something that the product team is working on with partners today. You're not going to find that any of the compatible phones have QoE reporting in them today. And so this is something that you want to, you know, make sure you're talking to your vendor about and make sure that it's on their roadmap that this is a gap that's going to be filled. So that may have sounded negative, but there's actually some very positive things that you should keep in mind about compatible IP phones. Link Phone Edition is fairly constrained in certain scenarios. Our partners in the compatible program have no such constraints. And they've done a lot of things in this program that we weren't able to deliver, in Link Phone Edition. And if some of these are requirements that are important to you, you should think about, you know, which are the right devices for you in your topology. Is 802.1x a critical requirement for you? If it is, you need to be thinking about devices from one of our compatibility partners. Wireless handsets. We have no UI or experience or capability to run Link Phone Edition on a Wi-Fi handset today. If you're in healthcare or you're in retail where that portability is important and you need a ruggedized purpose-built handset for it, you need to go talk to a SpectraLink, right? It's not a Link Phone Edition, but it's fully qualified, right? It's something that we support. There's even things that they can do that we don't necessarily even support in Link, but using our protocols, you can light up capabilities that we otherwise necessarily wouldn't be able to deliver. Something like intercom and paging, right? There's nothing that stops one of our partners from saying, okay, well, for a delegation relationship, I'm going to allow a phone on the reception on the executive's desk and a phone on the admin's desk with a single button to be able to be doing paging into the other person's office, right? Auto answer, speaking into the office. Now, there are a lot of things that for specific use cases, pockets of users inside of your company, that there are capabilities that these folks are delivering that this is where you're going to get that stuff from. You asked an example about, you know, how do I put a call on hold over here and then have the boss pick it up over there. This is something that our partners in the compatibility program can deliver for you with their phones. The cost of the phone, right? You got to buy the phone. And in terms of deployment, what are the things you want to keep in mind? I think some of these are obvious, but just keep them in the back of your mind as you're going forward. LLDP Med, this is important for things like E911, location of the port, so if people are making an emergency call, they can find them. Are you deploying power over Ethernet? Or are you going to invest in power bricks for all these phones that you're buying? Power over Ethernet is generally the recommended way to go. Some phone provisioning settings, these are all very well documented. The things that you need to do to make sure that devices can register to the network and register with Link, DHCP settings, network time protocol. You know, what is the process for deploying common area devices? The other thing that I think is important if you're looking at the compatible category is understand what custom provisioning needs there are for those devices. If they have custom capabilities, how do you roll those out? Right? Because They may implement extensions to link provisioning that allow them to sort of pipe that stuff through link. If they don't, you may be looking at either manually configuration of all the sets that you're rolling out. If it's a small number, maybe not a big deal. If it's a very large number, there needs to be a provisioning story. Everybody's got one, but it may be different than what you were expecting to use with link. So it's something to keep in your thought process as you're evaluating what to deploy.
How much time we have?
Negative time. We are slightly over. So I apologize. I poured through that last section pretty quickly. But any other questions now? We're supposed to go somewhere and answer questions after this. I just don't know where that is.
Yeah, so. I mean, there's Ask the Expert session too. All right, I think it's like 6 o'clock or something. I'm not sure, but it's on your schedule. So we will also be there if there is something like specific scenario. Even like I will be here like I think 20 minutes after the session too.
Yep, and we'll be somewhere between here, the hallway, and down at the Microsoft booth and the expo floor. So you know we've got 30 minutes here as well. So anybody has any questions, feel free. Thank you.
Thank you.